history of magic. Today we're going to talk about magic in the Renaissance. So if you look here at this engraving, this is a very famous image. If my memory serves, it's known as the Flammarion engraving, although it wasn't actually produced during the Renaissance. This gives an idea of the universe that the people in the Renaissance thought that they lived in. Here you see this man, and he's exploring nature. And they thought that nature was contained within a sphere, but that, you know, the stars were only so far away, and he could kind of go beyond and kind of reach into this world outside of nature. Right, so we also see the sun, the moon, and then back here we see a representation. This is a big wheel. It was believed that the heavens, the stars, were all part of a big wheel that was turning. And what was making it turn? Well, that's God, right? God was making the wheel of the heavens turn. Okay, so why am I interested in Renaissance magic? This is my specific field of study. This is what I'm doing it for my graduate degree. I'm doing a master's degree, and I'm working on one of these guys, Pico della Mirandola, so I can talk your ear off about this guy. I'm writing a 100-page thesis about him. Magic became a problem during the Renaissance. When did the Renaissance happen? Let's define it as after about 1400. After the year 1400, magic became a problem. Nobody was really worried about magicians the way they began to be worried about magicians in this time period. There's a few different reasons. I'll talk about a few of the problems of magic. One of these problems was paganism. I brought a book to show you. This book is The Pagan Dream of the Renaissance by a very important scholar in the field who studies magic, if you guys want to check it out. Paganism is the term for religion before Christianity, right? So paganism was the ancient Greek religion and the ancient Roman religion, and all of the old ideas, the sort of older ideas from Western culture. Not just religious ideas, though. Think about Greek mythology, right? You know, Greek mythology, Zeus and Hermes and Hera and Aphrodite, right? Or Venus, right? We name the planets after the Greek gods. What are the names of the planets, right? Mercury, Venus, Mars, the god of war. So, people often still sort of believed, or they brought the knowledge of pagan culture. And this was a problem for Christians in the Renaissance, because they thought, well, paganism, maybe it's bad, right? Maybe it's evil, maybe it's the work of the devil. Right, so there was this interesting presence of paganism in the Renaissance, and you can see it especially in the art. Right, artists in the Renaissance, which was a period of time during which there was a rediscovery of pagan learning and of pagan art. People were reading the classics, the ancient Roman writings, the ancient Greek writings, and people loved the ancients, the classical world. People loved pagan civilization, but it was a problem for Christianity. Right, so maybe if you were a scholar, you loved reading in Latin, and you loved reading all these ancient texts, you wanted to read ancient philosophy, but maybe if you were a priest, you were scared of that stuff, because maybe there's something bad in there. Even worse than artists who dabbled in paganism were the witches. Who are witches? Witchcraft beliefs held that there were people who could make a deal with the devil, right? Who could make a deal with Satan, and they could sort of kiss his rear end and get power in this world. And they could use that magic that they got from the devil to do harm, right? And the hunt for witches, the search for witches, became a preoccupation for the law,
during this time. It was also an interesting problem for medicine, right? Doctors often had to decide when somebody had a medical problem, is it a natural problem? Are they sick? Or is it a supernatural problem? Are they possessed by a demon? Is there a witch who's doing some bad magic on this person? Right, and during a time before modern science, before modern medicine, people died all the time. People got sick and died, and you didn't know why. Right, so a lot of the time, people were scared. There were many reasons that people were sort of scared of the world and wanted to believe in magic. Another reason is that believing in magic helps you feel like you have some control over the world, right? We talked about that last week. And so this guy who's exploring nature and sort of peeking outside, right? He's learning. He's gaining this important knowledge about the world. So I'm going to show you some cool pictures, and I'm going to talk about some of the famous guys in the Renaissance. And I've whittled it down to a list of six. These are my favorite guys. Marsilio Ficino, who was one of the great philosophers of the Renaissance, translated the complete text of Plato, right? Plato, who is the greatest philosopher in Western history. Alfred North White had said, all philosophy is really just footnotes to Plato, right? It's all just, we're still just kind of working on the project that he started. And so Ficino translated all of Plato, but he also translated some texts of other philosophers in the Platonic tradition. And he studied the texts of people like Iamblichus and Proclus, and some texts that were attributed to a guy, legendary, name was Hermes Trismegistus. Very difficult. Hermes Trismegistus. Who was Hermes Trismegistus? There was a god in ancient Egypt named Thoth. Do you guys know the god Thoth? What was he the god that ruled over? He was sort of a god of knowledge, of writing, and he's the god that supposedly gave writing to mankind. And when Greek civilization took over ancient Egypt, there was a sort of mixing of the gods Thoth and Hermes. Right, Hermes was the Greek god. He's the god of knowledge, of travelers, of merchants, of buying and selling, of going over boundaries. And what's this guy doing? He's going over a boundary. Okay. Now, there was the god Hermes, and there was also the man Hermes. And I have some pictures of Hermes to show you. Where do I just shut it by mistake? Now, Hermes Trismegistus was thought to be a man like Moses or like Zoroaster, who in ancient times was a sort of a wise man, and he was thought to be at the beginning of magic, the beginning of religion. And people thought that he had the secrets of magic. Right, the secrets of how to do that thing where you look outside of the universe to rise up above the stars. So here's a classic picture of Hermes Trismegistus. You may recognize his staff with the curving snakes. Do you recognize the staff with the curving snakes? If you go to a pharmacy, you see that picture, right? It's called the Caduceus of Hermes. And it was sort of his wand. And if you remember from Harry Potter, what do they like to wave in Harry Potter? They have a magic wand, right? So the Caduceus of Hermes is one ancient example of a magic wand. You see here that he's holding a representation of the globe and a representation of the heavens, the stars that spin around, right? And the orbs of the heavens. And you can see up here, this is a name of God up in the sky, because Hermes was receiving spiritual wisdom from higher, right? There was a god who was talking to Hermes. Hermes was just a man, but he was kind of a legendary man. He was a special man, like, you know, sort of like Jesus or like Zoroaster or like Moses. God talked to Hermes. So when Marsilio Ficino was translating the text of Plato for Cosimo de' Medici, one of the most powerful men of the Renaissance, Cosimo said, "Stop translating Plato. I'm about to die. I want to read Hermes Trismegistus. Right? Please translate this guy." So one of the traditions in the Renaissance that has gotten a lot of attention, especially since the 1960s, is called the Hermetic tradition. It's a tradition of ancient philosophy and magic, and one of the most famous ideas of the Hermetic tradition goes like this. As above, so below. The things in the divine universe are sort of related to the things in the material universe. Ficino believed in what's called astral magic. Now, this is a type of magic that was still seen as natural in his time. He believed that the different planets had different powers. If you touch gold, it's sort of like touching the sun. There are properties in gold that are like the properties of the sun. What about Saturn? Marsilio Ficino was also very concerned about the planet Saturn. I see that. And here's a famous image of Saturn. The planet Saturn was a bad influence, but it's also the planet of philosophy. So when people do philosophy, there's sort of a danger. Saturn is very heavy, and when you do philosophy, is your thinking going to be light or is it going to be heavy?
Heavy.
Do you get a lot of exercise or do you sit around and get fat? You're going to sit around and get fat, right? The life of the scholar is dominated by the powers of Saturn. And there's a disease that's associated with Saturn. We call it depression, but at the time they called it melancholy. There's a famous text from the English Renaissance called The Anatomy of Melancholy. People were exploring melancholy because they believed that it was a disease that affected people who had the life of the mind. Okay, so Ficino made a book called The Book of Life, or there's actually three books on life, and how to compare your life to the heavens. It was a book about how to do astral magic against melancholy. How to cure your depression. You're sick because you're thinking too heavily, right? What do you need to do? You need to go outside and look at the sun. You need to listen to beautiful music that is composed with the sounds of the sun, right? And you need to look at symbols of all of the good planets. So the planet Jupiter was a good planet. It represents an expansive influence. So you should go find things that are like Jupiter. The planet Venus was a good planet. And magic was very much associated with something we call Eros, the erotic, which is the power of Venus, sort of the power of attraction, the power of love. People who believed in Renaissance magic believed that all of the different parts of the universe had different attractions, had different reasons to be attracted to other parts of the universe, and a magician sort of knew the secrets of how to take advantage of those properties. And so he used the power of Eros to get his magic done. Ficino had a famous student, Pico della Mirandola, and I have a picture I'll show you. And Pico got in a bit of trouble with the Pope. Who's the Pope?
The leader of the Catholic Church.
Yeah, the leader of the Catholic Church, right? Pico came up with these 900 theses, and one of them, probably the most dangerous idea, magic and Kabbalah prove the divinity of Jesus Christ. Uh-oh. Why is this a problem? Remember we talked about paganism? Right, the Pope thought, well, magic and Kabbalah, those are either pagan ideas or Kabbalah's a Jewish idea. Right, that's not Christian, that's not good stuff. But Pico believed that in some way magic proved the divinity of Jesus Christ. And he began a movement known as the Christian Kabbalah. where there are a lot of Christians who are interested in the magic of the Jews.
What's the Kabbalah tag?
So the Kabbalah is a long story. The Kabbalah is a tradition of Jewish mysticism. And the word Kabbalah means receiving. There are two branches of the Kabbalah, according to one of the first great scholars, the theosophical theurgical tradition and the ecstatic tradition. And the theosophical Kabbalah, or Kabbalah, there's this idea that God has a body, and it's made out of these 10 sephirot, which are sort of the parts of God's body. And when you read the Bible, every part of the Bible tells you something about a different place in God's body. And when you do the commandments, Jews are supposed to keep the commandments, you are healing God's body. So, you remember the Hermetic idea, as above, so below? One rabbi that I studied with, Lawrence Kushner, said, you're sort of like God's chiropractor. God's back is really hurting, right? But then you do the right thing. You do some religious ritual, and God feels better, right? You cleared up some pain problem in God's body. So that's what's known as the theosophical or theurgical Kabbalah, where they're very concerned with these 10 sephirot, and they're very concerned with reading the Bible and discovering the secrets of the universe, the secrets of what you might call magic or mysticism, were found in the Bible, according to Kabbalah. The other tradition of Kabbalah was concerned with altered states of consciousness. Meditation, trance, fasting, all of these things, to change the way that you think, to change the way that you're experiencing the world. They use the names of God, they use the letters of the Bible, the letters of the divine name, in an attempt to change their consciousness, to become like prophets. And I'm going to show you a picture of a book by a man named Reuchlin. Do we see? Now right here you can see an example of Kabbalistic magic. Well, this is what they thought was magic. Now, if you ask a scholar of Kabbalah, it's debatable. Is this magic or not? There is a four-letter name of God. You may have heard the word Jehovah. Right, the four-letter name of God is YHVH. And in Hebrew, it looks like this. Yud, hey, vav, hey. This is a very powerful four-letter name of God. People would meditate on this, and here's an example of a meditation that you could do where they would change around the letters of the name of God. There was also a name of God with 72 letters, which I'll show you. So throughout the history of Kabbalah, it's a lot of fun if you like pretty pictures, because you can see all kinds of representations of this body of God. You can see representations of the different Kabbalistic magical diagrams.
Now, Ted, this is just a Christian Kabbalah, or is this also the nature of the original Jewish Kabbalah?
That's a great question. Now, the question is, how much did these guys understand Kabbalah, right? Pico della Mirandola believed that Kabbalah proved the divinity of Jesus Christ. He thought Kabbalah is really Christian. So he didn't really understand it. He learned Hebrew. He studied with some famous Jewish philosophers. His follower, Johannes Reuchlin, who was German, studied even more Hebrew and learned more Hebrew, and he brought kind of more of the magical stuff in, all of this stuff with the names like we saw in the book. But did they even understand the difference between theosophy and ecstatic Kabbalah? Now, Pico had a sort of idea. he thought that the Theosophical Kabbalah, well, that is the, that's the philosophy of Kabbalah. And the ecstatic Kabbalah, that's what he called practical, right? That's the stuff that you do with your hands. And this idea of practical Kabbalah, then there's also this idea of practical magic, right? These processes that you do to do magic. Well, is it a natural practice? Are you taking advantage of the rays of the stars, or are we starting to get supernatural? Right? When you're moving around the letters of the names of God, is the power of these letters natural, or is it a divine power? Is it a supernatural power? And if so, is that a problem? Right? Is that good religion, or is it bad religion? And a lot of people were sort of scared about that. This problem came to a head with Agrippa. His name was Heinrich Cornelius Agrippa. Another German who wrote the famous three books of occult philosophy. Now they're beginning to use this word occult. Occult just means hidden. You ever see an eclipse? When the moon moves in front of the sun? The sun is occulted by the moon. That's all we mean by occult, right? It's something that is hidden. But that occult philosophy is this idea that magic and these secrets of nature, they're all part of this big occult philosophy, which is about the secret properties, right? So if you know that gold has the power of the sun, that's because you know the occult properties of gold. Agrippa followed Pico in dividing the universe into three worlds. And Agrippa said, well, you know what? There's magic for each of these three different worlds. And I'll give you an example of some Saturn magic using sigils and pentacles that give you a taste of what practical magic was like. So you can see here, you ever do a magic square? The number of Saturn is 3. So we make a square, 1, 2, 3 by 1, 2, 3. And all of these numbers, if you make a line, they all have to add up to the same number. What do they add up to? 15, 15, 15. Any way you go, it adds up to 15. This is called a magic square. Okay, but then what they would do is they would take their magic square. And they would use it to encode the name of a spirit, right? And so if you start at number 2 and go to 8 and go back to 2 and go up, right, you can make a picture of a spirit. And if you look here, this guy, it almost looks like there's a little face, right? Really what we're doing is we're moving around, and the name of the spirit, right, the name of the spirit would be 7, 6, 5, 5, 9. But instead of numbers, there would be some letter that matches the number of the spirit. Right? So these are examples of practical, magical operations that people would do. They would also construct magical circles. And I think that one of the things that people did was they would just meditate on these diagrams. And the diagrams would have many meanings, many symbols, right, many words, magical words that they would inscribe sort of to create as much power as possible and to make it a very, you know, kind of a powerful meditation. So there's some examples of the kind of thing that Agrippa would do. This would be an example of celestial magic because it's the magic of Saturn, right? So you got natural, which is the Earth. Stuff like alchemy would be natural magic, where you're doing chemistry, you're using the powers of magic. Now, celestial magic is where you start to do these things that are supposed to get you in touch with the powers of the planets. Super celestial magic would be the highest form of magic, and here is where we have a real problem, because does super celestial magic do the same thing that religion does? And is magic trying to take away sort of the place of religion? What Agrippa really thought was that magic was good religion. And so I'll give you an example of his definition of magic. Here's Agrippa on magic. What magic is. Magic is a faculty of wonderful virtue, right? It's a good thing. Full of most high mysteries, just like science is full of mysteries or philosophy. Containing the most profound contemplation of secret things. We talked about how magic is about the secrets of nature. Together with the nature, power, quality, substance, and virtues thereof. It's almost like he's talking about science. Knowledge of whole nature. And it does instruct us concerning the differing and agreement of things among themselves. Those are the sympathies of nature, the correspondences, the way that things fit together. Do they agree? Do they repulse? Are they attracted? This is the sort of erotic relationships of the things in nature. Whence it produceth its wonderful effects by uniting the virtues of things. Now, wonderful effects was something that science was in the business of doing. And as the Renaissance proceeded, and we got into the Scientific Revolution, or what we used to call the Scientific Revolution, there's a kind of a different history now. In the Scientific Revolution, they started using a lot of that language that people used to use about magic. So there's a lot of interesting scholarship that I love to follow that traces how, when people were thinking about magic, this is sort of the prehistory of science. Before we had science, we had magic, we had philosophy, we had various different arts and crafts. And some of the thinking that went into the development of modern science was happening in the territory of magic. How are we doing for time? We are running out of time. A couple other examples of magicians during the sort of end of the Renaissance are John Dee and Giordano Bruno. These were two of the sort of last of the magicians. Some people say that Isaac Newton is the last of the magicians. I'm glad somebody brought an apple, because that always makes me think of Isaac Newton. Because Isaac Newton believed in alchemy and practiced alchemy, studied all that stuff. John Dee used magic to have conversations with angels. He used a very complicated system using the books of Agrippa and all of that angel magic and that good stuff. Here's an example of John Dee. And John Dee would look into a mirror and see spirits. Well, actually, he had a guy named Edward Kelly, who was a scryer, who did that for him. Dee didn't have the talent himself. And they would talk with angels and ask the angels, am I doing it right? Am I doing the magic correctly? How do you do magic? Right? And the angels were giving them the knowledge that science couldn't get them. He was also the astrologer to Queen Elizabeth, and if I've got my story right, he chose her coronation date using an astrological table. The last guy, Giordano Bruno, is one of the most famous magicians of the Renaissance. He was burned at the stake in 1600 for being a heretic. He did not believe in what the Catholic Church believed. He believed in this thing called the art of memory and the infinite universe. He thought that other planets had their own suns, and that there were aliens and stuff like that. So in 1600 he died, he was burned. There's a very famous book called Giordano Bruno and the Hermetic Tradition that I'm going to talk about in a future lecture that really revolutionized the study of Renaissance magic and made it popular in modern scholarship. Next week we're going to talk about the decline of magic. The Decline of Magic is the famous thesis of Keith Thomas. This is his book, Religion and the Decline of Magic. After the Renaissance, as the Scientific Revolution proceeded, people who believed in the Enlightenment, who believed in science, said, hey, you know what, magic is really anti-science. Magic used to be a religious problem, right, where we were worried about paganism and witchcraft. But then, after science comes on the scene, people start to say, you know what, magic is just stupid, magic is irrational, and we need to get rid of magic. If we're going to be scientists, we can't be magicians. So next week we're going to talk about the Enlightenment, we're going to talk about the Protestant Reformation, and the decline of magic. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Does anybody have a question before we go?
Sure thing.
All right.
I would
love
to ask you some questions.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry I've talked over my time. Well, thanks again, and I'll see you all next time. Well, I hope I can see you all next time.